Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we're talking about the love of writing. Martin, how long are you writing this book?
I've been writing since I was about 14, Tony.
Yeah, and what age are you now?
About 25, yeah. 26.
If you switch the six and the two, you'd be closer if we're telling the truth.
Listen, before we go any further, we're doing a live show. Tickets selling out fast. It's on the 22nd in the Wiley Fox at 6:30 p.m. Saoirse McHugh is going to open it up for us. We love Saoirse. She's so cool. So please get onto the website, tortoiseshack.ie, get your tickets. You can always join and become a patron and get a discount. You can get them that way too. It's a good way to get them. So as soon as you can, sign up because they'll be sold out soon. Thank you.
Much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined by features journalist for the Irish Times. Writes short stories and also is a good man to have a pint with, Patrick Frame. Patrick, thank you so much for coming over.
Thank you for having me.
No, like Martin actually said to me, no, this is going to be a bit of a strange one because you're kind of, Tony, don't fanboy. So I shouldn't declare that at the outset, but I am a big fan of your writing. And we're going to always talk with recency bias because we always do. But even your stories that you wrote this week on the day of the budget about, the children in those positions whereby, can I ask you, the stories that the Irish Times, that you write for the Irish Times, do you pick them or do the stories pick you?
It's a real mix. So like I kind of went back to journalism after trying to be a musician for ages when I was in my early 30s and I was a freelancer for ages. And I kind of, as a freelancer, you run around doing everything that you can to make money. Mm. So I did business journalism. I did kind of, and then I, you know, started doing features and columns for the Tribune. And I definitely developed things I like writing about and I think I'm good at writing about. Mm. And I like having kind of a certain amount of diversity. So I like writing about silly pop cultural things so I can just make jokes. Mm. And I'm also just really interested in talking to different kinds of people and to some degree, readdressing kind of biases. I think some people aren't represented enough. Mm. That's partly because journalists aren't representative enough. You know, journalists are from a kind of narrow enough cadre of people. Mm. But in the absence of that, you try and interview people. So that story you mentioned, is about, it came from the Jack and Jill Foundation. Mm. They said, would I like to interview some of the families who, use the Jack and Jill Foundation? And the Jack and Jill nurses basically go and help families who have very sick and often dying small children, disabled small children. The nurses do amazing work. But also, like when I went out to, I realized the story is a bit about the nurse, but it's actually about the cases, the two mothers who are doing, as they said, stuff that nurses are highly trained to do. But a mother who has a very sick baby or a father who has a very sick baby suddenly finds that they've got to learn how to do all these incredibly difficult medical things with a really sick child. And and it's a privilege to write about stuff like that. And it's a privilege when people bring you into their house to tell you those stories. So like I go away from those. Like it's one thing when I go and I interview someone who's sort of famous. Mm. I kind of feel like they can look after themselves. If I interview like an actor or a politician, they can give as good as they get. Mm. But if your job is to represent people who are not used to being in the media about a very difficult situation where they're a little bit vulnerable, although those women were incredibly tough as well as vulnerable, you actually come away with this. Well, I come away with a huge sense of responsibility. Like I get really worried when I'm writing those pieces. Mm. Like you want to create like a,
well, you want the best foot forward.
Yeah, you don't want to hurt. Yeah. So you don't want to hinder them or accidentally, like not that you'd ever try to, but like that, you don't want to accidentally hurt them.
There is a sense too in particularly in most journalists, you're looking for a gotcha quite a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And then there are interviews where you just, it's not a gotcha situation. It's not you're not there to score anything. You're there just literally to tell the other person's through your lens.
Yeah. So I was never particularly interested in the gotcha thing. Like the good thing about being in features journalism is that like I've had really interesting conversations with other people in the Times who are on the newsier side. Mm. because they are news hounds. Mm. And you're probably a bit more like that, like where breaking stories are really, really important to them. And breaking stories, I hate to say, are kind of boring to me because everyone else has got it too.
Yeah, yeah.
And I kind of like the nice thing about features is you can, okay, we work very hard and you work longer on pieces, but you can also work a bit slower on pieces. Like you can take your time to get it right and to shape a story and to tell a longer, more in-depth story. And for me, it's the idiosyncrasies of humans that make a story really interesting, because those two women, like, and actually everybody is fascinating. Like if you are with them long enough and you ask the right questions, which is why I love my job. Because if you're, and the luxury is that in the times we still have time to, like, I think some younger journalists now don't have the time to spend talking to people.
We've heard that quite a bit from younger journalists we've interviewed, the pressure to get copy out there, to produce, to have something there. It's huge pressure, and it's very quick move from one to the next to the next.
And it's coming from the internet too, like the new pressure that didn't exist before. And I don't think it's informing people better. Like I think
it's TLDR. You know, the first paragraph, you pretty much tell it in the first paragraph, and the rest is an explainer for the first paragraph, you know?
But even the just churn of the news, like I don't think that churn, like I realized a long time ago, like everyone else, I did that thing where you watch a breaking news story through the night.
Yeah.
And I realized pretty quickly that if you went to bed early and listened to a news bulletin in the morning, you'd actually be better informed than if you watched it through the night, because your head is now filled with misinformation, the same thing told from a million different angles that aren't helping. And actually, like, I'm a believer in slower news anyway. And
Ken Early made a great point. I don't know if you heard it this week, where he said he was getting onto a plane when the Colleen Rooney and Rebecca Vardy story was breaking. And, you know, guess what? Ken's into sports, and this would have been kind of a bit of fun. But he was like, oh, God, he's just this thing. And he's like, turn your phone off. You're getting on the plane. And he got off, and he said, but the revelation was he got off the thing, and there was no point in commenting because the internet had taken it in the time the plane took off to the time the plane landed. Yeah. And it had already developed, delivered memes. It had delivered, this is how it happened.
That's almost a new thing. That's not even, like, I wouldn't even put that in the same class of things I was given out about.
No, I know.
That's almost like an amazing thing. This group mind shapes this insane story that probably has no bearing on reality whatsoever over the course of a day. And there's like moments like that. I can't even remember, but every now and again, David Cameron and the pig or things like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like where everyone is just involved in this joyous piss taking.
Yes.
When that happens, I go, I like social media. I like social media. When I love
it. Some people call that a pylon, but it's not really. It's the humor behind it. The wolves this week from the Green Party, the story about the wolves. It's the same thing. Look, we understand the basic principle behind, if you biodiversity, then you can support wolves at the top of the food chain. Yeah, well, we get that. But it's still something to poke fun at.
But it's just brilliant. Yeah. I think I tweeted that it was just an amazing twist in the apocalypse. We're going to have, okay, as well as everything else that happens, there's going to be wolves. There's going to be wolves too. And like, that's, like, I love, I kind of like social media for that. Like, I have a real...
You only have a one foot in social media.
Yeah, for my own mental health, I stop. Like at the weekends, and like I often leave the house now without a phone because
he doesn't want to be tracked.
Really? That's true, yeah, that's true.
That's a better reason than my stupid mental health.
I don't want to be tracked. I'm quite averse to people knowing shit about me, even though I don't get up to anything. It's my business.
So, because the tyranny of, like, I've developed all these rules for myself that are to do, like, I don't look at the phone on the bus. And I don't look, I have this rule now because I tell you, this is going to sound more highfalutin than it should, but I interviewed someone years ago about loneliness. It was someone through a loan, and she said she was an older woman who lived by herself, and her only interactions were with people out in the street and on the bus. And she said it was way harder now because everyone was looking down. So I never look at my phone when I'm in a lift or at a bus stop.
Oh, yeah.
if there's other people there, just not because anything's going to happen, but I just, what she said got into my brain. And when you look around and everyone is glued to the thing, it is like Black Mirror, and yeah, it is.
That's what I see.
Yeah.
That's what I see when I'm out and I don't have a phone. I mean, and I just see, and I mean, yeah, the amount of times people are literally walking up to you with a phone and then they look up and
they blame you.
Well, I don't even mind the blame. It's like, there's like, just take those little blinkers off and just look there and there.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like look, sooner or later, they'll wire into our brains and you won't have to carry anything and it'll come up on a soft screen over your eye and you'll be able to interact with everybody whilst you're tweeting.
But there's, you know, too many people. Like, so my other problem with Twitter, like I go there and I'm there, as you said, kind of a one foot in, and I go there for a while and then I go away and I go there for a while and I go away. But I just think did you ever watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
Yeah.
There's an episode of Buffy where she becomes psychic.
Right.
And it's really good fun at the start. And then she starts to go mad because there's too many voices in her head.
Yeah.
And when some days on Twitter, I just feel like I know far too much about what strangers think about stupid shit.
Yeah. And I think now there is a critical mass there, where it does become where, like, you know, someone said, I can't, there was an editor of one of the newspapers said something a couple of months ago saying, you know, how many people do you block? And, you know, and how many people? And I went, I don't block anyone, but my God, if I mute, like nobody's business.
I
you
use
know?
The mute button more than the block.
Yeah.
I don't block people because I don't want them even knowing.
That's, I think that's a generally a good rule, you know, it's just.
Well,
it's
I
just,
think Twitter keeps the other voices out of your head. Yeah.
Yeah, this took a dark turn.
Yeah, yeah. just,
I think it opens up so many points of view. That's what I like about it. I mean, I would have had lots of opinions that have changed over the years simply because of stuff I've looked and read. And, you know, it was Twitter that always twigged you onto it in the first place. My opinions have definitely changed over the years.
That's probably true of me too over the years. I just feel like there's as much reinforcing of my views as there is challenging my views.
Now, that I'll say, if you just follow people you like, you'll end up down that road where it's constant bias confirmation. But if you're kind of a broad spectrum of people, and I mean, there's sometimes tweets come up my timeline, I go, oh God, I so disagree with that, but I'm not going to block them or get rid of them unless they're rude, obnoxious. You know, there's a couple of things, but you know, if they're voicing an opinion that I find really nasty, but it's not personally nasty or it's not to hurt, you know, you get a neoliberal who's going, oh, Mark will solve everything.
Because I follow people's diversity like that. It's just more, I still think only a subset of the population are on Twitter in Ireland.
Yes.
Oh, God, yeah. It's really small.
And I think it's very middle class. And I think it's, so there's a diversity of opinion, but within a certain group.
It's funny because they talk, it's more, you can see it more in the US, where Twitter can shape a news cycle, and the political news cycle more, even, you know, quite quickly. But they always shout, but Twitter's not the real world. It is the real world for those people that are there.
Yeah, it's a bit of the real world.
Of course it is. These are.
Everywhere's the real world.
Yeah, exactly. You know? So if these are real interactions and real feelings, and it's the real world, but nonetheless, you know, then you step out and someone else has got, you know, have you heard? It's like, no, you know, if you're not there, and so it is a false economy as well. But as a features writer, the world of Twitter, I could see why, you know, something that's limited to 280 characters that is doesn't allow for nuance and seldom allows for nuance.
So the other thing, and like the other problem I have with social media, and it's back to, I remember a friend of mine was involved in a social media startup back 10 years ago. And I used to come in every now and again to help out. This is longer than 10 years ago. And at the time, the gist of things was that social media was going to bring all this new journalism to the world.
Yeah.
And that there'd be loads of investigations going on. And ultimately what's happened is it's just filled with people's opinions. Mm. And like, no offense to opinion columnists, but it is the most useless form of journalism.
Mm.
Like, I mean, there's some great opinion columnists, but so much of it is just there for people to feel good about their already existing views. And what the important thing that's going to disappear if journalists and newspapers disappear is the really boring stuff and the stuff that like the council meetings or the
Reporting that matters, yeah.
Or like the stuff that is that had, they've always had a watchdog role in, you know, and to some degree features journalism, like where people actually spend time with people and get, you know, get deeper into.
Well, I don't see anybody else sitting down and doing a feature about a day in a library, Patrick.
You see, I love doing stuff like that.
Well, that was really well received.
Yeah.
It must be one of your most read pieces, I'd imagine.
Yeah, probably was. Like, what happens with some of the stuff that I'm happiest with, like that, is that you go in and you end up meeting loads of really interesting people from really, like things you don't really expect. Like, what I didn't really expect was, which is a bit naive of me, is I didn't really expect how many vulnerable people use the Central Library.
Mm.
Like, I didn't really realize how many homeless people use the Central Library. And these are, a lot of them don't look like homeless people.
Yes.
They're just kind of, they're the kind of the homeless people who pass as people with homes, you know, and they go there because it's quiet and they can sit down. And as one of the guys was saying to me, you know, the library staff are really nice to them. They only get embarrassed if you fall asleep. So, you know, and I think, loads of people, like, I believe in, like, the old social contract stuff. I believe the state should be really involved in libraries and parks and galleries and obviously health and education and housing should be a given. And I think when you do a piece like that, there's so many people out there who know that and they just want to see that argument expressed. So when you do something about the libraries and how important the libraries are, the reason it's well received is because there are loads of people out there who know how important the libraries are, and they just want to see that story represented.
Have you trained yourself to listen over the years?
Yeah, like, I'd like to think I always listened a bit, but I'm definitely, I definitely ask more questions now in day to day life than I would have done 15 years ago.
And that's the experience of meeting people and knowing that everybody has a story.
Yeah, and actually, the interesting thing is, we, for a while there, it's to do with different needs of different mediums. For a while there, that we have a really good video department. And early on, what they were trying, they were experimenting, they'd send a video guy or girl out with me or someone else. And you realize that you've different needs. From the video person needs the story to be told really quickly and efficiently. And what I've found for the type of story I do, it's better to allow people to just talk for a while, you know, and then they'll say something that you go, hold on. And actually, the thing that continuously strikes me is that most people don't know what other people will find interesting about their lives.
Yeah.
So people just gloss over something absolutely fascinating and you go, hold on, can we go back to that thing about you stealing cars when you were six?
Because
people are so used to their own lives that they think you sometimes meet people and you go, and they start telling you something quite ordinary and dull, thinking it's really interesting. And you kind of feel like going, no, this is the bit of your story. This is the bit you need to kind of tell people first.
Yes.
You know, and my job then as a features writer is you're trying to represent people fairly and represent their story fairly. And obviously there's selection involved, because if I sit down for someone an hour, you could get a 10,000 word transcript.
But what I find, and this is going to come across as it's meant to be a compliment, but it's not supposed to be a compliment. Is that
backhanded?
Yeah. is that, at least I find you don't insert yourself into the story, which is really effective. Some of the worst feature writers that I read occasionally find they don't realize that they've almost projected themselves into the story. I think you manage to do that quite well, where you walk that line, and that's a skill. Like, I don't know whether that's a modesty in you or it's just that's your style, but it helps when, if I was someone who was to sit down with you and you wanted to put something forward, I'd say, well, this guy will represent me, as opposed to there's some people I find want to
be the star of the show.
Yeah, like, it's like look what we're doing, Martin. This is a shrine to me and you, like.
But this is journalism, right? This is like, you interview people and you get people's stories and takes and things out there, right? So there's a place for the journalist in, like, even in print stories, anytime I insert myself in the story, it's when the interaction is elucidate something.
Mm.
So it might elucidate their sense of humor, or is elucidate a word?
It is now.
They might,
we'll paint it on doors tonight. It'll be in the dictionary by tomorrow.
So what it works is when, like, actually John Ronson does it really well in his journalism. So he's got a particular persona, and the way people react to him is sometimes tells you something about the person. So when he's inserted in the story, that's the purpose of him being in the story. And that's the way I view feature writing. Like, if I appear, it's for that purpose. Also, I get to kind of show off my personality in my column, which means that I don't feel like it's leaking out into the feature stories.
Well, that comes out when you do your, like, if you do your pieces on pop culture stuff, you know, and that's, you know, it's a shared experience where, you know, all of Ireland sits down to watch Strictly. And then Patrick comes out with a column like a few hours. Last night I was watching the, you know, and we get this column and it's a communal experience, but it's through your eyes then. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, like, I do think it's important that people are, other people's stories are represented, and there's an issue with, like, as you've mentioned here before, like, there's an issue with representation.
Yeah.
Like I said, in media, and in the absence of having people able to represent themselves, because that isn't there yet, you know, you want to be able to tell other people's stories and tell people's stories accurately. And sometimes the writer has the skill to present that person's story in a way that represents them. And that's kind of what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Do you find it that it holds back journalism, that they, and I'm not saying it's right across the board, but that generally journalists, particularly successful journalists in Ireland, a certain socioeconomic group, a certain social strata, do you find that that's holding back journalism in general?
I think it always has. And I think, I think the water protest was the big time recently, where I think that mainstream journalism didn't get it because they didn't live in the estates where it was happening. And if some of us had been living in the estates, I remember seeing the first big protest on O'Connell Street and kind of going, are we allowed to curse in this
book? Oh, yes. yes.
But kind of going, holy fuck. I was just in town that day and I hadn't really been paying attention. And I wrote a big piece in the water protest afterwards, but, like, I think we missed that because of that reason. I think, and increasingly it's the case in the Western world, like Ireland a little bit less than Britain and America, but journalism used to be, like, I think Mark Twain called it the poor boy's university.
Yeah.
Like, you used to go in, if you were literate, you went in on the first floor and you made the tea, and if you were smart, you made it and you went up, and it was more like a trade. And, like, a lot of things, in inverted commas, professionalizing it by making it a degree course is a barrier for other people. Mm. Like, it's a barrier for people who aren't kind of middle class.
And it's kind of a catch 22, because without the professionalization of the occupation, you don't get the same respect from the same people who would have worked their way up through journalism. They are now the ones making the decisions on, well, you need a degree to be a journalist, or the days of somebody coming in off the street and becoming a journalist are very, very few and far between. But
loads of great journalists started that way. Like, I went to Trinity did an English degree. I did do a postgrad in journalism, but it was useless. And I have no idea what people, everything I learned about journalism, I learned through trial and error. I was freelance for years, so I didn't even learn in a newspaper office. I kind of learned by
practice,
by freelance, by failing, failing to get stuff published, and then, you know, getting stuff published eventually. And then the more you do it, and then you're dealing with and all the stuff Chomsky talks about, but like internal bias in newspapers, and you know, certain kinds of articles that you write will get published and others won't, and you've got to reckon with that to make a career.
Publications self-curate. Have personalities.
Yeah,
you know, and if you don't write to the personality that publication is, you're not going to get published in that publication. That's also, I see, a problem with freelance, in that you can't actually, as a feature writer staff, you have a freedom. you have a freedom to, you know, this security. If you want to write something a little controversial, there's a security there. Yeah. Whereas if you're a freelance and you want to make a living, and I'm not, nobody's talking about making a fortune, just making a living, you got to write the way the editor is going to publish.
Now, I think there's a misconception too, like, because I often found that things, so, I read, do you read Manufacturing Consent? The Chomsky book?
Yes.
Right. the main thing I took away from that book was that the biggest problem is self-censorship.
Mm.
People assuming something's not going to get through. And I made a decision because I remember friends of mine, I came into journalism a little like I did it a little in my early 20s. And then I was like a very talented but unsuccessful musician.
just never discovered.
Exactly. And then I went back to it and I was a bit older and I kind of decided I'd never self-censor.
Mm.
And what I discovered in the process of never self-censoring is that loads of stuff will get through and loads of stuff will get in that you might go, they're going to cut this. Like I still, and I have to say, anything in recent years that has been cut, I agree with in retrospect. And it wasn't for political reasons, it was usually taste. Like I remember a thing I got into when the blasphemy law was going through.
Oh, I remember this.
Well, this was in the Tribune. Yeah. And this was like, it was when Dermot Hearn brought in the blasphemy law.
Yeah.
And I had a line in my column that I went, there's no way they're putting this through. And I just said, Christ's cock, exclamation mark, there's a new blasphemy law. And I picked up the paper on Sunday and actually felt embarrassed. I was like, oh, I thought they wouldn't put that through.
Yeah.
Like, so there's I think there's a misconception. Like, I don't remember any point where I was told I couldn't write something or when, something was, something kind of political or sensitive was cut.
And Ireland is different because obviously we have a problem. We have an issue whereby, you know, a thin-skinned tax exile decides that he doesn't want to speak to people from the Irish Times or as it is now, Tom Lyons and Ian Keogh's new venture. And these things, you know, like that's not what we're talking about here, about self-censorship. That is just.
I'm going to get t-shirts and caps made up that said, can't appear on News Talk. You know, it's something like really good journalists.
No. I did point out to people on Twitter that I've been not appearing on News Talk for years.
Well, I did, for 7 years, I did, until that happened, I was doing the TV slot on Matt Cooper's show.
Yeah.
And just overnight it stopped. And okay, at the time I wasn't that angry because I was a bit overworked. So I was like, okay, good, I don't have to do that.
Yeah,
and
then,
the more I thought about it, and I do get kind of angry about it because that's, both those stations are filled with people who get really bolshy about free speech, you know, and then this happens and I think we've responded well in the Times. Like we have done nothing reciprocal, like we have Sean Moncrief writing for us and he's got a show on News Talk. We have a big ad about Communicore today that they obviously pay for. So they've no problem being advertised on us.
Oh no, I agree. I do find that irrational. I mean, to the point where some of their bigger names are bastions of, you know, free speech. They've learned a misattributed Voltaire quote and they throw it at you all the time and you're going, well, you know, you can't be that selective. And it is, It's infuriating when you look at it because it's a very small media market. And if you're going out to the public, for example, Rachel O'Neill does a brilliant podcast on here called Disturbing the Peace with us. And she wrote a piece for the Irish Times about her libido. And if you recall, it really flew, like it became a big thing. And she was invited onto News Talk and they would never say where the article was published. Right, yeah. And you know, imagine sitting there with Ciara Kelly going, you know, and Rachel, you wrote this piece and, you know, and you're just.
I also have sympathy with, like, there's a lot of kind of really interesting argument about what free speech even is at the moment. Because obviously, like, these are private companies and they can do what they want. So censorship traditionally was all about governments.
Mm.
So when people go up, like, YouTube have banned my video feed, like General Doherty or whatever. Like, well, then I guess what you're kind of arguing for is that And I kind of buy into this, that these are utilities and they should be nationalized, right? And then we can talk about censorship. But at the moment...
They're a private company.
They're private companies whose main business model is by making us angry enough to say shit.
But, you know, even in Ireland, the very notion of free speech, when we have such draconian defamation laws, you know, we've never really had... I can't really say what I think about people that write... I can't.
Well, I get this envy when I read, like, I love American magazine journalism. When you read the New Yorker, Vanity Fair, and they'll have a line about a politician they're profiling, and it'll be as blunt as... He's believed to have taken bribes in the 80s.
Mm. Yeah.
And in brackets, they'll just be, he denies this, right? Here, that would have you cleaned out if you made a statement like that about somebody. It's hard to make a statement about things that have actually been proved in tribunals because you've got to parse it really carefully. Yeah.
Wealthy people in Ireland tend to be very thin-skinned. They tend to be very... I mean, there is stuff that goes into all kinds of media, newspaper, broadcast, about... socioeconomic groups that don't have power.
Yeah.
You can say anything you like about single parent, somebody who's homeless. You can say anything.
The ad on the end of, I hate to say it, but so someone is found dead who was homeless, and it will say automatically they had issues, they had problems, and it's always added. If you added that
known to the police, is known the other to, one.
Yeah, exactly. Oh God, I hate that phrase.
It's a really terrible phrase. But, what does that mean?
It means you deserve to die.
Because I'm actually known to some police people.
It means you deserved to die. That's what it means.
Can I come back on that though? What's really, really pisses you off, me off, about the known to police phrase is that you will then have, and this is as a gospel truth, you'll have someone who is from a different class will then have the conversation on a podcast, and they'll say, "Oh, sure, you know, I was doing coke at the time," and everybody says, "Yeah, they just did coke at the time," and it's grand. But the guy who was known to police was probably a young fella who did coke.
So there's a number of people then that we should just start referring to just apropos nothing, former drug user.
Pick that one significant in their life, you know, that one thing that they don't want remembered, and just open it with that.
It is infuriating.
Former knicker thief.
Now we're getting into it. Yeah. We better stop naming.
He's revealing his own proclivities. You mentioned the video, and then you also mentioned some of the other features writers that you admire and that you like. If you've seen things now about going and telling the stories, I don't know if you've seen, say, John Harris's Anywhere But Westminster series, where he goes anywhere but Westminster. Yeah. He's out there, so he'll go to a small town, and he'll literally stand outside the shops, and the poor cameraman has to wait until the magic happens, you know, and it's just a conversation.
And that's the problem. So people have kind of rightly but also wrongly been given out about Vox Pops recently, because I guess some of what I do would be called Vox Pops. The problem with Vox Pops is if you go out there really, really quickly and you get the first three people who speak to you and you get their not particularly interesting points of views, like, it can be really, really interesting if you spend a lot of time doing it, which is hard, but which is kind of what John Harris does, to be fair. Mm. Like, he doesn't just put everyone he catches.
No, absolutely not.
Open the thing.
It's a 6-minute video, but there was probably 6 hours of video.
Well, this came up recently, and it came up in relation to the public services card, and they went and did a Vox Pop after the report came out, and three people, I won't even say what station it was, and they interviewed three people on the street. Oh yeah, I find it real handy. Yeah, I love using it. Yeah, makes things real. But if you phrase the question, your data's been illegally harvested, and at the end of this, you may be able to take a case against the state for this. Oh, those bastards. You know, it depends on how you put it.
And I guess it also depends on what the point of the question is. Like, I mean, if it's a question that should be really put to an expert, there's no point in going to a bunch of people on the street who don't really know about it.
I agree with some of the criticism of Vox Pops.
No, same here. But I don't think that's what everyone does. And when you talk about anything but Westminster, like, I've got this theory that every newspaper should have a poll caller who's not allowed to talk to politicians, and whose job is to talk about policy, to talk about, you know, politics and talk about what's happening in politics, but who is actually forbidden to talk to politicians or their staff.
Well, I meant to ask you, I'd say it earlier, but when you spoke about missing out on the water movement, that was where that was lost, missing out. And I remember Vincent Brown making a great point where he was there with Rita Fagan. If you know Rita at all, she's basically a legend from
absolute legend.
Dolphin House, working class activist. And he's sitting there and Vincent spotted Rita. And he said, in a crowded room, and he said, there's Rita Fagan. He said, the problem with journalism is that lads go into the Leinster House bubble, and what they should be forced to do is only 2 weeks in Leinster House and 2 weeks on the front line with Rita. And he said they would never lose sight of who they're actually supposed to be reporting for, not the.
So, because I guess there's a need for the Leinster House. Yeah. Stuff, right? But it's more that the idea that politics is filtered through politicians is a flawed view of politics.
Yes.
Because politics is a much broader thing, and how it affects the country is much broader. And future policy, stuff that we don't even know will be policy in 10 years, is now being discussed by other people, academics and activists and people who are totally currently disconnected from it, but might be plugged into it in the future. And that's when you see the future movements. Mm. And that's when you see, and again, you're back to, you can't blame individual people for this, but you're back to where people come from and what is being talked about around them.
Sports has a lot to answer for.
Does it?
Yeah, because a lot of reporting is now reported like sports, whether it's politics or whether it's you know, who's up, who's down, who landed a few blows there, and you're like, he made a point.
Well, a huge problem with them, just to give Irish media credit for a minute, like, I've been looking at the way British media has just descended in the last 2 years, and I think we look good at the moment, and largely because they are entirely viewing Brexit through the prism of Westminster, and it's constantly, like, they're taking seriously things that if they looked outside of Westminster, you could not take seriously, but they're so lodged in that bubble that they think that this is about the Tory party and Labour, and they're forgetting that it's also about Fine Gael and Barnier, and they focus everything through that little.
And 48 million people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that's but the
when,
reality.
When I think of, you know, Ireland's recent history in talking politics, what stands out is when Vincent Brown went on the road and did those people's assemblies.
And he made a huge effort with his panel generally.
It was not only gripping TV, it was kind of like the Joe Duffy show on a vast scale, where you're actually hearing what Middle Ireland thinks, which you don't get if you're stuck in the bubble of Leinster House. You just don't get it. You have to get out there and actually meet the people.
So because he made a huge effort generally. I think, particularly in the last few years of the Vincent Brown show, he made a really big effort to go beyond the normal talking heads and the politicians, and he brought people on just that he'd heard of, or that somebody told him were interesting, or activists.
But they were interesting.
And they were interesting because they weren't being. And the problem, the difficulty with that for media and for journalists is that people who are really used to talking to media are easier to turn into articles, right?
Plus, so they're not going to libel you.
Yeah, there's all these things. Like, they're used to the media. Like, people used to go, why you're such, you know, I get people going, you know, why are such and such a historian always quoted? Or why? And the reason is because they pick up their phone really quickly. Yeah. And, like, you might even find out here with this, there's some people just really easy to get access to.
It's even stranger than that. What we see are we talk to people who are lesser known.
Yeah.
And, you know, within a few weeks, usually, the likes of the Tonight Show, they'll get a call from a producer and they will end up on the show. But what happens is inevitably is that they go from a format where they've maybe done this podcast, they've maybe done something else small, and then they're thrown to the wolves because they're put on a panel that is, have this balance, please. Which, and the two moderators are definitely not really like, let's tell the truth here. They're playing a game as well.
They're like referees in WWF. Yeah.
Well, that's the other problem is that what makes, and I have such mixed feelings about this. I still don't know what the correct response should be on social media when you're annoyed by something. Because I definitely feel like sometimes when everyone starts giving out about something on a TV show, the producers are just rubbing their hands.
Exactly.
Glee.
Yeah.
And like, I kind of feel like people are falling into a trap. I know, like, my own policy is I don't tend to get angry on Twitter and I don't tend to personalize it just because I don't know what the use is. Mm. And I also don't know what the use sometimes is of just adding to the, to the noise, the
cacophony.
Right?
Well,
I too think this is wrong. You know?
Let me give you my nuanced take on why your nuance lacked nuance, right?
Yeah, but that is that. Come on, that is part of the sport of it as well.
But
it
this is why what you were saying, it's a sport. Like, I think it's social media is also a sport. Mm-hmm. So people need to kind of, there's a human nature element, and I. Definitely. I mean, this shouldn't even be controversial anymore. A lot of people who are fighting recreationally, right? They're going on there for a fight. And maybe they're even lying to themselves about that. But I kind of look at it sometimes and I go, this is creating a weird, distorted version of reality, which is my other problem with social media is I don't think it is a real world, but it's not the only real world. Mm-hmm. So what people are getting het up about in social media, like you kind of said earlier, I'd say all of my friends who are not media related aren't on Twitter. And I go to them sometimes and go, have you heard about this? And no.
Yeah, that's my world. That is my world.
Someone like Jordan Peterson, right?
Oh, God.
He's an entirely a creation of social media. Yeah, yeah. You move away from social media and most people I know haven't heard of him.
Yeah.
You know?
That is very true. And I kind of, that's the world I inhabit. Like the guys I went to school with, pals with, I was saying, such and such happened, so and so. Yeah. Never heard of it. No, not really interested. Did you see what happened with the football? No.
Yeah. No, it was on social media.
Going back to the actual writing itself, are you still working on the short stories? Is there still?
Yeah, I took 3 months off earlier in the year, and that's the other good. They let me, which is great. Unpaid, but they let me, and that's a kind of good position to be in. And I was writing. I'm doing a book of essays for Penguin Ireland, which is going to be out next year.
Yeah.
And I've been writing short stories and I've been just like, people go into journalism for different reasons. I always was, like I said, I wasn't a news hand. I was really interested and I am really interested in people and stories, but I'm not always particularly interested in what's high on the news agenda. And I guess I wanted to learn how to write without a deadline for a while.
Okay.
So I have been writing short stories and I have been writing essays that are a little bit more personal.
And you're writing these short stories. Have you found that you've found a theme or why should I not even ask?
So I've
you're not getting the answer to
that. I had one in Banshee, the literary journal earlier in the year. And I kind of really like fantastical kind of, I guess, I figured because my journalism is about the very real world, and I don't think I could have written realist short stories because that's my day job.
Mm.
My day job is producing nonfiction realist short stories. Mm. So the short stories are a bit more fantastical.
And do you like fiction as a break?
Yeah, I actually, I think I like other work as a break from work generally.
Okay.
Like, kind of like moving from one thing to another. Mm. It's kind of.
And to say, like, I know I get stuck writing a lot of stuff that's non-fiction, but I do love writing fiction.
Most of your tweets are fiction.
But genuinely love it.
I mean, this is entirely fictionalist. How long did we rehearse this?
But genuinely love it. Genuinely love the escape of it. It's something you can so escape into.
It's just got a different feel. Like, it also for me, like I was saying earlier, I feel like particularly when you're not dealing with kind of people who can take it, when you're writing about vulnerable people or you're writing about real people's lives, there's such a huge sense of responsibility. When you go to fiction and they're entirely made up, it's just so, it's such a relief. Zero, I don't have to worry about these people.
I love that you're talking about it, because I'd be the worst guy, because I would have this skin in my head going, yeah, I'd love to write this, and then I read something, and I mean this honestly, I could read something and I go, he's had the phrase in that. No, I can't write. I just put it away. You know? I'll stick to my 280.
Oh, I like to. Mine's just mainly for pleasure, Tony. It's not. Not. There's not nothing more to it.
You're not getting a book deal. That's for sure.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I've set myself a target before I reach 85. I think that's realistic.
So what have we got? I'm gonna, dear listeners, that's about 22 years.
Is there a big novel there?
I don't know if I, like, I kind of started writing short stories again, because I used to write them when I was younger, badly. And then maybe 3 or 4 years ago, just on the side. And I guess it's harder to project in, like, because I'm so used to writing shorter things for my day job that the short story, and I read lots of short stories as well.
And it's a lovely format. It's a really good format. The short story, a piece, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 1,000 words, a short story. You can go, 2,500, maybe up to 5,000 words.
Yeah. And and actually in the times with features, we can go long. So there are, like, I'd write 3,000 word pieces a fair bit.
Great.
And there's some like Rosita Boland's written some amazing long features in the last few years. And that is like, I mean, I got, the journalism that got me really into journalism was like the really highfalutin stuff, like the Tom Wolfes and the Joan Didions and the, you know, Truman Capote, you know, where they're writing like, 20,000 words on something. And I still think that in Irish journalism, we can still aim towards that. And there's still some really good long journalism being written. It's just the demand is increasingly for shorter stuff.
And there are great writers still out there, and there's great new emerging writers. And, you know, I'm seeing people now. I've even seen other organizations in the internet sphere dipping their toe into it where you know, people are being given their head.
Like Conor Gallagher's amazing piece about the horrible murder case.
Yeah.
Like that was I think that might have been 10,000 words long, but you didn't feel like it. You were just, it was all you needed to. And again, back to what I was saying earlier about his piece, in a way, was all you needed to read.
Oh yeah.
It was unsensational. It was very upsetting, but it was very beautifully crafted and straight. And it was a way better way of absorbing.
There was actually a touch of Capote to it, to be honest. It was that kind of very calm way of telling something that was very awful, that was just very awful, but told in such a way that it was a very calm telling. There was no emotion in it. And I think for me with Capote, Capote just takes his emotion out of everything.
Like I loved In Cold Blood, you know, the Capote nonfiction story of murder trial. And I still love it, but the more I've read about the construction of that book, like he was an amazing writer, Capote, but not the most ethical journalist. Like it's amazing.
Does Tony say? Good and great are seldom the same thing, you know.
Which is another quote I stole, Martin. So don't be crediting me.
But it's really true. Like I still think In Cold Blood is amazing, but like he just kind of a lot of that new journalism, and I reread a lot of it recently. It's beautifully crafted, but sometimes it's too beautifully crafted. Mm. Like reality isn't as beautifully crafted. Yeah. And there's this kind of weird line you really have to stay on the right side of the line for journalistic ethics.
Yeah.
Which Conor Gallagher definitely did with that piece, which was
brilliantly
amazing.
So are you going to give us a little, what's the next piece there? A little window on what's coming, or do we say you have to buy the paper to read the story?
Oh, no, I think what we will say is you do have to buy the newspaper. and that's one thing I will say about social media that does piss me off. And I'll finish with this. It's the trope of someone's written something bad, never buy a newspaper.
Yeah.
You need to cut that crap.
That really does bother me because, yes, you've every right to be annoyed, but all news organizations make bad calls sometimes, but on the same day that the problem is what gets the most traction on Twitter becomes for a lot of people the front page of the newspaper.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's like, it's a story that was not given prominence in the paper because we weren't giving it prominence and it might have been a bad call, but in that same paper, there is always really good journalism, really important journalism by other people. And we don't always get things exactly right. But it's not going to be replaced by blogs and tweets. And it's unless somebody starts seriously funding it or paying for it. Mm. You know, and the best way actually to keep like malevolent forces out is to pay for it yourself.
Yeah. Well, we have said that a couple of times. We have said if you want good journalism, you do actually have to pay for it.
Well, actually, something I've said before is signal boost the stuff you think is good. Like every, and I am obviously biased, so I'll say it, almost every paper has really good stuff in it. And if you want the paper to do more of that good stuff, signal boost that as much as you're complaining about the bad stuff.
Clickbait,
because part of the problem with the clickbait stuff is sometimes the metrics just say loads of people read this.
Yeah.
You know, and then they go, well, people like reading about this terrible thing.
And not even that. What they do is quite often is, as you expressed earlier, is they get the opinion pages and they turn them into, well, they trend on Twitter.
Yeah.
And it's only because it's outrage. It's like, you know, pulling. I talk about it as on Twitter, you're refreshing your screen to see what the next outrage is. Like you're pulling down on a one-armed bandit
And actually, the problem with that as well is that I've experienced a few times people are forgetting what journalism that isn't opinion journalism looks like, some people. Yeah. And I've had this thing where I've covered things and people have said to me online, but I don't know what you think about it. And I'm like going, that's kind of good. Like I just presented what people said.
Yeah.
But if you're in a particular ideological bubble, you start expecting journalists to say, this is good or this is bad because you're reading nothing but opinion. It's really important that, and nobody's unbiased, right? Mm. But it is really important that there is journalism out there that isn't actually beating an ideological drum, that is just going, we went to talk to these people. Mm. This is what they said. We don't endorse what they said. This is what they think.
Yeah.
And we're presenting it. And I just kind of worry that everyone expects a heavy dose of opinion with everything.
Yeah.
Well, it has moved that way, but it is really nice to see people doing feature stuff because it's kind of the endangered species of the endangered species.
Yeah.
So it's nice to see good long form. It really is nice to see good long form.
Like the really endangered species is investigative journalism, which is a totally different thing. And that the only way that happens is with money, like, and time and giving journalists time, which is why the currency is hopefully going to do stuff like that.
And there's a couple of others out there at the moment, and we're hoping that do make a difference, and they do. Yeah. They are making a difference, which is we can see for ourselves. Thank you so much for coming in and having a chat with us. I hope you go off now and have a nice evening for yourself after a week's work. It's been lovely to talk to you. Tony, we'll put it over to you.
Yeah, thanks again, Patrick. Listen, folks, we're beating the drum here. Do pay for your news. And if you do feel like you get something out of these pods, throw a few bob into the Patreon as well, because they don't pay for themselves. Martin has, what's that, a Coors Light hat on you, mate? So we'll actually want to buy him one, except for the one that he got free with the six pack.
I actually got that off a brother-in-law. I didn't even pay for it.
Talk to you all soon, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.